Gabfest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political Gabfest, the struggle in Ferguson, Missouri between police and residents following the death of unarmed 18-year-old Michael Brown. Also, the New York City police investigate the chokehold death of Eric Garner. Will anyone be punished? I'm Emily Bazelon in New Haven.
And I'm Dana Stevens. On this week's Culture Gabfest, can the weather be more than just uninspired small talk? And then, Steven Soderbergh directs Cinemax's new TV series, The Nick. Is this a new addition to the golden age of television, or just a hospital melodrama shoved into a time machine? And finally, we'll remember the great comedian and actor Robin Williams, who died this week at 63.
On this class, you can either call me Mr. Keating, or if you're slightly more daring, oh, Captain, my Captain.
We'll start with the Political Gabfest right after the news.
Welcome to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm Emily Bazelon in New Haven. On this week's show, we'll discuss the struggle and upset in Ferguson, Missouri, following the death of Michael Brown, an unarmed 18-year-old shot to death by police. Then, the case of Eric Garner, who died in a police chokehold on Staten Island. Where will the investigation of his death lead? Joining me are Yale Law School professor James Foreman.
Hello.
And Yale political science professor Veshla Weaver.
Good to be here.
Michael Brown was supposed to leave for college on August 11th. Instead, he and a friend named Dorian Johnson got into some sort of altercation with the police that left Michael dead. Dorian says the confrontation began when he and Brown were walking in the middle of the street and an officer approached and told them to get on the sidewalk. There's an eyewitness who says there was a verbal confrontation, and when Brown started to flee with his hands in the air, an officer got out of the car or from the car shot Brown. The police say that Brown hit the officer in the face and that officer went to the hospital with a swollen cheek and that explains the shooting. Whatever the actual incident itself, and I think it's really hard for us to know the answer, this has blown up into a set of protests and struggle and anger and dismay in the city of Ferguson, Missouri, which is just outside of St. Louis, part of St. Louis County. And I think many of us have been watching as the police have been reacting, and I would say overreacting, to the shooting, showing up in riot gear and shooting tear gas and rubber bullets into a peaceful crowd. So I wanted to start by asking you what you think about whether we know that the Ferguson cops were in the wrong here. Do you think we have enough facts to have a sense of that when we're talking about the shooting itself? Or is it really the aftermath of the shooting that has kind of grown larger and taken over the story?
First of all, we need way more information than we have right now. But based on my read, even if the youngster had assaulted or pushed at the cop first, that is still not measure for reacting with lethal violence, right? And certainly not to shoot somebody as they're retreating in a submissive pose with their hands up, saying, I'm unarmed, you know. That's my read on it. I think the broader aspects of the case are what's concerning to me as a political scientist, right? The anti-democratic aspects of the case. No police accountability yet, no information, keeping the media out, not releasing the police officer's name, approaching it in riot gear with tactical force. That's what's most concerning to me.
And there's a weird racial overlay to all of this, right? Ferguson, there are 21,000 people who live there. Two-thirds of the city is black, but the leadership of the city is overwhelmingly white. 50 of 53 police officers, the mayor, most of the city council.
Yeah.
So it has this oppressive sense to it simply because of that.
I don't understand those details. I mean, I've been trying to figure out for the last couple of days what is actually going on in Ferguson just on that point, because that's not true of that many communities in 2014. I mean, what we know about the right to vote and the Department of Justice has analyzed what percentage of a district needs to be majority black even given the fact that lower income people might vote at lower rates? What percentage of a community needs to be majority black for them to be able to elect a representative of their choice? And the numbers are in the mid-50s, high 50s.
And so this community would seem to be able to vote this leadership out of power, right? Mm-hmm.
We need to hear from people on the ground in that area who can tell mm-hmm. us what's going on. Because not even that's just the mayor. I mean, we're talking about a city council, right? These are multi-member
right.
districts.
Right.
You would think
right.
that they would be able to elect some members of the city council. I heard a number in the New York Times said that there were no blacks on the school board, which is,
yes.
again, a 7-member
mm-hmm.
district. Those are the things that you need to change to be able to then change the police force. You need to have a police commissioner who's reporting to a mayor and a city council who's responsive to that community. That actually seems like it would be possible to achieve with those numbers of a 67% black community.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we're kind of missing the ethnographic history of Ferguson that would tell mm-hmm. us. I mean, we know that this city, there's been a tremendous amount of white flight since the early 1980s. It was majority white. It basically flipped. Mm-hmm. It seems like in part because St. Louis itself was zoned in a way to make it hard for lower income people to move in. But Ferguson allowed for apartment buildings that are less expensive. And so some lower income people, some of them black, moved there. And yet we seem to have this leftover white power structure, which seems like this weird antiquated artifact, unless you're right and we're just missing something here.
I mean, I talked to a couple of people about this just in the last couple of days from St. Louis to try to figure this out. And the answer that I kept getting was Ferguson is very small. You're talking about 20,000 mm-hmm. people. People don't think of it necessarily as a geographic community that they need to vote in. And you add to that some transients, people living, you know, in apartments. They move from here to there. So they're not invested in changing the local power structure. I bet they will be after
now.
This.
Yes, yeah. Right, right. And that'll be one really interesting test or lesson will be what comes out of this is the collective action, which right now has been leading to some peaceful protests. I know that wasn't true last weekend. In the aftermath of the shooting, there was looting. But what mm-hmm. we're seeing now are people standing on the streets and trying to exercise their right to mm-hmm. free speech and mm-hmm. assembly, as far as I can see.
This is what makes the police response so curious to me. Why wouldn't they immediately, even if they believed in the officers' well intentions, say we're setting up a civilian review board, we're going to take the steps taken in these other small cities, we're going to immediately meet with the family, we're going to bring in leaders that have dealt with these issues before. When people feel like they have outlets where they have a democratic channel to express themselves, they do peacefully. When they don't, you see looting and you see rage.
So you used the word innocent to describe Michael Brown. And you feel like you know enough to use that word. I mean, we know he was unarmed. Maybe he got into some kind of struggle. Certainly there was a verbal altercation. One witness said she saw him tussling with an officer mm-hmm. kind of through the window. I mean, to me, that's still not enough to mm-hmm. get us anywhere to the point of, you know, the use of deadly force and their mm-hmm. really limited constitutional standards, legal standards on when the police are allowed to do that, which James will lay out for us in a moment. So I can see why you would use that word, but I think a lot of people would hesitate until we know more to say that Michael Brown was blameless. But maybe you're not using innocent to mean the same thing as blameless. Or maybe you just feel like there's such a difference in power here that...
All I know is that he was walking down the middle of the street. To me, that's an innocent childhood behavior. I've done much worse in my adolescence. That's all we know so far. So until somebody gives me more information, and even if they give me more information, how many youth commit minor level things? You know, drug offenses, spray painting buildings. When white kids do it, we think of it as innocent boyhood.
I'm not, when you originally asked the question, you know, do we know what happened? Can we come to a judgment? I don't feel like I can. Mm. And so for me, whenever these cases happen, somebody immediately wants to start talking about, well, who did what?
Right.
And then even the question about should they have released the name? I mean, so many of these questions to me are somewhat beside the point, at least the way that I feel it emotionally. This case is about a phenomenon. It's about a history. In the individual case, we never know a day or two later. I mean, this is the partially the defense lawyer in me, but it's just the truth. We just do not know right after the fact. And we often, sometimes we
never
don't,
find out.
We never know. Mm-hmm. And or it's something where it remains disputed, even after mm-hmm. a trial. People have different reactions to the evidence that they witnessed, you know, through the lens of the media. But what we do know is that incidents like this happen time and time again. Mm-hmm. There's just such a long roll of names. Mm-hmm. When I look at my law school students now and I talk to them about this case and I see the pain that they're feeling and caring. I mean, I remember being in law school and for me, you know, it was Rodney King.
Yeah.
And everybody has, mm-hmm. you can just pick the moment in time when you first were overwhelmed yes. by how hard it is to be Black and male, and Black women suffer too, but Black and male against a law enforcement apparatus that so often makes assumptions about you. And that heaviness and that mother, the quotes from that mother, mm-hmm. from Michael Brown's mother, when mm-hmm. she talked about she thought she had made it, she thought she had done it, mm-hmm. is so hard. And she thought she had, and now she lost her boy. That pain, that's the pain that I feel from these cases.
And that is the pain of centuries. That's the other thing. When you were saying, what do we know? What we do know is a historical patterning of this kind of white law enforcement, majority white against majority Black, violence. And I'll call it violence. If you go back to the Black newspapers of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, one of their biggest running commentaries were pleas for help against police violence against their communities. Headlines that raise the goosebumps on your arms. Headlines like Negro life cheaper than a hog's. Penalties worse for stealing a pig than murdering a Negro. Headlines like that. And so if you are a youth growing up in this time, you've got Obama, you've got some things to celebrate, but then you also have these constant reminders that regardless of the facts of the case, a Black boy died and bled out in the street. That's what you're seeing.
The fact that the people of Ferguson could vote in new leadership on their own
right.
gives me some righteous yes. sense for them. But I do feel like nationally, we are so far from solving this problem, and it just keeps popping up in different places.
What do we tell our children?
Right.
Right? I mean, I have a Black child, and do you know my first thought when this all came out was, man, I'm thankful he's light-skinned. Now, how bad is that?
That's really depressing.
It's really, I'm glad he's sort of racially ambiguous.
Ooh, that's heavy. Coming up, Eric Garner died in a police chokehold on Staten Island. Where will the investigation of his death lead? This is GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Emily Bazelon, along with James Foreman and Veshla Weaver, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. Last month, a 43-year-old man in Staten Island was allegedly choked to death by several Staten Island police officers. He was standing on the street. They accused him of selling cigarettes without collecting taxes. He said that he had actually been breaking up a fight. There's a video of this incident, which I found very hard to watch, in which the confrontation goes from verbal to physical in like a split second. And then Garner is in a chokehold, and it's pretty clear that he can't breathe, and yet the police don't let him up off the ground. So this death, too, has led to a great deal of social media outrage and has really put Mayor Bill de Blasio on the spot in New York. He's supposed to be this liberal mayor coming into power. And is he going to hold the police department accountable for this death? The police union has been really pushing back against any kind of big statements from the mayor condemning the police department. So what I wonder looking at this case is, do we have the right rules for thinking about how police use force? And I was wondering, James, if you could talk about that a little bit.
I think the rules, by and large, are okay. It's a question of how those rules are implemented. So, I mean, the Supreme Court has said in a famous case, Tennessee versus Garner, the police can use deadly force when a suspect is fleeing and there's probable cause to believe that the suspect will pose a grave threat to the officers or to the public at large. So nothing close to this incident. I mean, this is not going to be decided on what the rules are for the use of deadly force. This is going to be decided on whether or not this was an illegal chokehold and whether the officer could have reasonably known that their action was going to produce the result that was produced, or whether there are other factors like asthma or otherwise that contribute. I mean, that's how all of this is going to play out. So I don't think that the problem here are the underlying rules. I think that the problem is, do you have a culture in which police have been allowed to cross certain lines? You have a rule that says you can't do chokeholds, but in fact, we now know from the reporting that there have been a lot of chokehold cases.
And only one person being punished, only one officer in the last few years, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for me, the really big issue in this case, and the thing that, again, where I think something could change over time, is this question of the role of the unions. So, and you alluded to this, if you think about what's happened in our country in terms of the teachers' unions and how the teachers' unions in many quarters have been, some would say demonized, or others would say, you know, held to account for protecting people. So where is the same level of criticism and critique that's being applied to unions that are protecting either police officers or prison guards? Rikers is the other thing that's going on. And in both cases, these union leaders are incredibly aggressive. I mean, they are speaking, they're basically being disrespectful to city council members at oversight hearings and saying, well, we're going to do a work slowdown. I mean, imagine if a teacher took a kid on a trip and the kid drowns in the river. And imagine if Randy Weingarten started yelling at this, how dare you hold us accountable for this? I mean, it's remarkable to me.
Right.
And this is something that people could campaign around. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean we don't want to have unions, right? Of course not. I'm a union guy. But it does mean that there are going to be certain moments where we're going to say, you know what? You cannot defend that kind of you can't defend that action.
But what would bring greater police accountability? Are there kind of best practices out there? Are there places that have managed to navigate this tension?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is about leadership, right? So we know for police departments that there are a group of police leaders that have been pretty aggressive about saying, you know, we want to have community-oriented policing. Mm-hmm. We are going to, of course, we're going to protect and defend our officers. But in fact, we think one of the ways of having a less violent city and officers under lesser threat is to have officers who are respected by their community. Yeah. So,
but I also mean in the stricter sense of actually punishing, you know, malfeasance when it occurs. So if you look at data on police misconduct cases, I mean, most cities settle, they go to bat for their people. Officers are rarely, if ever, disciplined. Rarely do prosecutors bring criminal charges against them. I mean, I wouldn't just say New York is alone in this. I mean, the case that comes to mind of chokeholds is the famous Lyons versus LA case, where basically the finding was that 75% of people that had died in police chokeholds were Black. And the court said, you know, you have no standing. You got to show that this will happen to you in the future every day, you know, as you go about your daily life. I mean, that just rips out the rug from under any claims of citizens being able to hold the very institutions that have the greatest power over their very lives, to hold them to account.
So does this seem like a test for de Blasio to you? Does that seem like part of the story?
Mm-hmm. I think it clearly is both the individual case, but also more broadly, the whole investment in a particular style of broken windows policing, which is, I think, that's going to be the question coming out of this, right? Because that's what produced the incident to begin with, right? Why are they hassling this guy in this way?
Maybe he's selling cigarettes without collecting taxes, right. Which is the exact right. kind of small infraction that yeah. broken windows policing is all about, right?
Yeah, and also to have a conversation about how and where broken windows policing is enforced. I mean, I was just earlier today, I was talking to one of my students. He's an undergrad at Yale, and he's from New York. And he was telling me that the Staten Island case, what was so eye-opening and demoralizing and in a way just sort of angering to him, was how different the relationship is between these communities and the police from what he grew up in. And he's policed by the same force. And he talked about, you know, he's in the Upper West Side. He went to school, high school in the Upper East Side. And he says that he and his friends would go and get high in the park. And if they saw a police officer, they'd put it down. But the scent is still lingering. And they had no concern that they were going to be hassled, let alone killed. And that's the other thing about these cases that I think can be so frustrating and so demoralizing is so many of the things that, you know, as Black people we're asking for or we're demanding or we're saying, you know, we need this are complicated, like good schools and adequate health care. And, you know, it's like there's many systems and but not being killed by the police. Is not complicated. And so when you can't even get that on a regular basis, then you are left to wonder, what do you tell your kids?
My mind kept coming back to, you know, sort of the basic responsibility of government is security of personhood. And this is a currency that Black people do not enjoy.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm Emily Bazelon in New Haven. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Dana Stevens. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, we remember the inestimable comedian and actor Robin Williams. And then Cinemax's TV series The Nick. It's a modern medical drama shoved into a time machine. Is it another hallmark for the golden age of television, or just one more tired hospital show cliche? Joining me today is Slate's editor-in-chief, Julia Turner. Hi, Julia.
Hi, Dana.
And also Slate's deputy editor, John Swansburg. Hey, John, good to have you.
Hey, Dana, great to be here.
All right, so Robin Williams, the beloved actor and comedian, died. This is the kind of topic that's always hard to get into because it's so sad and so heavy, but it's also, in this case, I hope a topic that will bring people some laughter and some memories. So obviously, you could talk for days about Robin Williams' career, which lasted decades and decades, and we wouldn't get everything in. And I just wanted to ask the two of you sort of what memories you wanted to bring in first to start the discussion.
For me, it was Dead Poets Society. I'm not ashamed to admit. I mean, that movie... I watched the first half hour of it before taping the show, and it made me cry already in the first half hour.
And we all have a great need for acceptance, but you must trust that your beliefs are unique, your own, even though others may think them odd or unpopular, even though the herd may go, that's bad. Robert Frost said, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference. I want you to find your own walk right now, your own way of striding, pacing, any direction, anything you want, whether it's proud, whether it's silly, anything. Gentlemen, the courtyard is yours.
And the thing that actually struck me the most watching it, the thing I'd forgotten, both watching that movie and listening to his interview with Marc Maron, which Marc Maron recycled yesterday and with a very moving opening, and which I'd never heard before, was how quiet his quiet voice was. I'd forgotten his soft shoe, because you remember the exuberance and the wildness of his big performances. But he knew how to control their power by giving you a very quiet and subdued self as well.
This is something that really, really struck me, kind of widely sampling from his work last night, is that he really did have this strange lightning in a bottle kind of talent, that he had this electric, manic energy. And yet some of his greatest roles, I think, the movie that I rewatched last night all of was Good Will Hunting. And that's one of those roles that he's so hushed, but there's so much kind of rage and pain inside of it. It's a great, great performance.
Yeah, I was struck by that same thing. A.O. Scott mentioned this in his appreciation in the New York Times, that sort of lightning in a bottle quality. And I think one of the things that's so interesting when you're watching one of those performances that is largely reserved is that you know that that lightning is going to come out at some point in the movie, and you're just sort of waiting for it to happen, and that kind of gives the performance its own electricity. You're like, when's he going to drop the sort of soft voice, kind of reined in Robin Williams? The movie I watched last night was The Birdcage, where although he is, you know, famously playing a gay man, he's playing a far more restrained gay man than Nathan Lane is, who plays the cross-dressing star of this drag show. And then ultimately, in the sort of climax of the movie, he's playing a gay man playing a straight man, so he's even restrained by another level. But there's this wonderful scene where he breaks out and is showing one of his underlings how to do this dance number in the drag routine, and he just does this incredibly flamboyant, funny history of flamboyant dance thing.
You do an eclectic celebration of the dance. You do fussy, fussy, fussy. You do Martha Graham, Martha Graham, Martha Graham, or Twyla, 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 or Michael Kidd, Michael Kidd, Michael Kidd, Michael Kidd, or Madonna, Madonna, Madonna. But you keep it all inside. All right, just work on that. I'll be right back.
And for a second, you see that crazy, anarchic Robin Williams, and then he puts the lid back on, and he's the sort of more restrained Robin Williams. And waiting for that moment to happen is, like, really exciting. You know it's coming.
Right, and the strange thing is that it's impossible to say which is more Robin Williams. I mean, we're not even talking about the private Robin Williams that we can't know, but as a performer, it's sort of hard to say which was his essence. Was it that Jonathan Winters, like, you know, crazy container for different voices and psyches that could just burst up, you know, essentially his stand-up persona? Or was it this more gathered, almost shy and quiet person that he could sometimes be in interviews as well?
There's this sort of thread of thought that I feel like various people who, in writing about Williams' death, have picked up that I find both compelling and slightly worrisome at the same time, and I'm curious what you guys think about it. You know, there's this, obviously Williams was someone who was just sort of constantly channeling this amazing energy. When you watch him, particularly on, say, Carson or doing one of his late night appearances, is almost like he's on to the next joke before he's even finished the one he's telling. He's just there's this idea kind of out there that you almost feel like you're watching him running away from his true self, that he needs to be constantly performing, constantly pleasing, and just that that energy is, while what made him special, also kind of tragic, because you feel like you're watching someone who has these demons flee from those demons. And while that's an interesting kind of psychological analysis of Williams, I worry a little bit that it's a little easy. Like, what if he was an anarchic talent who was also depressed, and not an anarchic talent who was anarchic because of his depression? I think it's a little easy to draw the line between the two, but I don't know if that's something you guys thought about.
I think you saw some of the same thing in responses to Philip Seymour Hoffman's death earlier this year, the sense that incredible talent and incredible sensitivity to human emotion and ability to inhabit various human psyches is almost symptomatic of the disease or the addiction or the pain that caused the addiction or whatever. And I think you're right that it's a little bit, I find those points a little bit troubling as well. They may be true, but it feels like when somebody who's not the doctor says, well, X caused Y, or it doesn't seem like we can truly ever understand the relationship between the manic energy, the pain, the depression, the performances, or anything else.
Yeah, there's no way to extricate those things. And the performer himself doesn't understand or master that relationship in either case.
One other thing that struck me rewatching clips of Robin Williams last night was just how much he's sort of fallen out of the cultural conversation a little bit. I mean, he had become a little bit uncool, in part because he had made very erratic movie choices for a while, in part because I think he'd been struggling with these demons for a few years. But, you know, there was a time, I mean, I grew up in the age of Robin Williams. He was the premier comic. He was magical to watch. Anything that he was in, you kind of automatically wanted to see. And that hadn't really been true for a while, I think, in part because of some of the career choices he made. I mean, Dana, I think you were looking through his filmography last night, right? And there are some strange patterns there.
Yeah, you know, in terms of kind of trying to periodize his career and the choices he made, it really struck me that there were sort of two kinds of roads he would go down. You know, when it came to his movie choices, he could choose things that were sort of sentimental and mawkish, which I think he did not only for the paycheck, but because he was drawn to that kind of material, family stuff like Patch Adams, Mrs. Doubtfire, you know, or just very, very sort of heavy sentimental drama like Jacob the Liar or What Dreams May Come. And I think that may have been some of the stuff that made him, Julia, start to be on the more uncool side of the comic spectrum. But then almost as if to counteract that, or maybe just because there was another part of him that was drawn to this, he would be in these very, very dark roles like One Hour Photo, in which he plays a stalker and potential serial killer, or Death to Smoochie, or World's Greatest Dad, you know, things in which he was essentially playing the reverse, you know, the darkest possible version of the warm family man.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I should clarify, of course, that by cool, I don't mean like having value or not having value. I think it's just interesting the way his mode of comedy has come in and out of vogue over the last couple decades.
I think that's right, Julia. But I also think it's important to remember that he kind of remained a comics comic. Even if it is true that he had sort of fallen out of the popular culture's idea of what cool comedy is right now, there's no question that the cool comedians, including Louis C.K., kind of venerated Robin Williams. And that's one of the nice things about listening to that Marc Maron podcast is, you know, the sense of kind of what an eminence he was among them. All right. Well, the conversation about Robin Williams is not over. It's still out there in the culture. So please write into us at facebook.com/culturefest and send us some clips of your favorite scenes, your favorite moments, or your favorite stories. Coming up, filmmaker Steven Soderbergh breaks into the little screen with Cinemax's turn-of-the-century hospital melodrama, The Nick. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Dana Stevens, along with Julia Turner and John Swansburg, and this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things we mention on the program, we collect them on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please leave a comment while you're there. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. One program note, GabFest Radio will be ending its run on this station on August 24th, but you can still find the podcast versions of the Political and Culture GabFests in iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search for Slate GabFest. All right, on to our next topic. Cinemax's The Nick is a new TV show created by Steven Soderbergh about a hospital in New York City at the turn of the century, the Knickerbocker Hospital, hence the name The Nick. Soderbergh supposedly retired from filmmaking a year or two ago. He announced that he was done as a filmmaker, but obviously he is now scratching the itch by going back to TV in what I would call a sort of cinematic mode. The Nick stars Clive Owen as the anti-hero Dr. John Thackeray, who is, help me describe John Thackeray, he's a coke-addicted, Asian prostitute-frequenting...
Racist. Boorish.
Boorish doctor.
But pragmatic.
An excellent
surgeon.
Doctor. Yes, who specializes in... Is he just a general surgeon? I guess we don't know.
I think there is only general surgery right. at this point, because they seem to be barely figuring out what it means to cut bodies open and put them back together.
But despite all of the anti-hero qualities I just named, he is, in fact, a very dedicated surgeon. And so the show is sort of about this balance, a sort of a house, you know, like the TV show House, a balance between, you know, someone who's very committed to his job and to saving lives, and at the same time is essentially a very unpleasant person to be around. We've all watched a little bit of The Nick and are ready to talk about it now. I have no idea what either of you thought of it. John, I'll start with you. The Nick, yay or nay?
Let me start with a caveat, which is that I watched the first episode while inadvisedly eating 4 pieces of tuna sashimi, which I do not recommend. I also have a wife who is almost 8 months pregnant. And the show opens with
Oh, she did not watch that C-section scene.
Thankfully, she was not home. But the pilot opens with a just truly gruesome scene of these doctors attempting essentially a cesarean delivery at a moment where that had not been perfected by a long shot. And it is just a really hard scene to watch. Now, I should say I am incredibly squeamish. So this show was never going to be for me, just on the level of just sheer difficulty of watching. I confess that I kind of walked around my TV during various moments in the pilot and kind of listened but didn't watch, because it was just too much blood. It was too much viscera. I had a really hard time with that. That said, I also just didn't like the show. I found it very pat. I found the anti-hero character, Thackeray, the sort of genius doctor who is medicating himself within an inch of his life, to be a very kind of boring and predictable character. I found the sort of noble black surgeon who's introduced in the pilot to be a very thinly sketched, at least at first, character who also operates in very predictable ways. I found the sort of tedious historical irony that the show trucks in to remind me of the worst elements of Mad Men from its first season, which thankfully it ultimately grew out of. So I found very little to like about this. Wow. I did enjoy my sashimi, though, after I put it aside for a little bit.
Wow, that's a rousing dismissal.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I'm going to jump to the show's defense, but first I want to hear what Julia has to say.
I see John's points. It's super gross. I mean, you know, it's Cinemax, which is supposed to be one notch maybe beyond HBO, or at least is supposed to have the outre qualities of premium cable. And so it sort of makes the houses and ERs of the world look like these dainty, doily covered shows where they talk about these gross, grisly medical procedures But you're not usually actually, like, looking at spurting blood coming out of the rubbery gut of, like, a severed human, you know, who's about to die. Like, they sort of... Then the camera pans up at the focused face of George Clooney, and there's just none of that. It's just like, let's look at the blood. It almost resembles, like, a surgery reality show or something. At some point, like, it kind of reminded me of Botched, the plastic surgery reality show we talked about a few weeks, and it's just unflinchingness about giving you the gore, which does seem to be something that premium cable viewers want, certain of them. I can't say that I would, there, for me, it was a lot of, like, arm flung over the face, listening while looking at the bottom third corner of the screen and waiting for the blood parts to be over. I agree, you know, that the anti-heroicity of Clive Owen's character is just so snoozeroo at this point. Oh my God. I would have been so much more exciting if he'd just been like saintly.
Yeah.
You know, if he was just like, cocaine? Never heard of it. Black surgeon? Come on in. Like, there's enough that's kind of interesting about the show. Just the sheer notion and novelty of putting a super predictable procedural back 100 years and all of the challenges of the medical technology and knowledge and lack thereof of that time, to me, that's novel enough. And when you're, you know, rejecting the black surgeon, but not rejecting him for sheer racism, just pragmatism about wanting the business to succeed. So he's not even enough of an anti-hero to be like just an actual racist. He's a racist you can root for. It's like, come on, we've seen these tricks before. We have to get over the anti-hero thing. That said, I love period television, and it doesn't get done often enough. There was a round of, hey, let's all do period television after Mad Men became such a hit, and then everyone realized it was expensive, and you don't always get the lightning in the bottle of Mad Men, so people shy away from it. And the notion of just doing a straight medical procedural in 1900 is great. I think that's just so fun. And I think it should be like almost as straight and pat as possible. Like, there should just be crazy cases and crazy obstacles, and some of the doctors and nurses should fall in love. The kind of genre-loving wit of Soderbergh, the more that can be infused through the show, like, more power to them.
I think the vision of the period that Soderbergh creates, okay, first of all, we haven't mentioned this, but the production values are sick. I mean, it looks like cinema. It's beautifully designed and imagined 1900-era New York. So if like Julia, you're just a period nut and you enjoy seeing, you know, not just the pretty costumes, but sort of like, what did the streets of New York look like? What did the medical equipment look like? You know, how did people sort of communicate? I think that even the language... The storytelling is not what it should be in this show, but a lot of the dialogue, just scene-by-scene dialogue, is kind of interesting. In the way that Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood does, it sort of has period language without having flowery language. You know, people speak in a slightly more formal way. They use fewer contractions. You know, there's sort of a little bit of a sense even that the English is kind of older English. And I liked all of that stuff a lot. I also happen to be crazy for Clive Owen. I love Clive Owen. I think he's so underused. I don't understand why he's not like James Bond and, you know, every other hero. He's so rakish and charming and funny. I just think he's great. So even though this character is one that is overfamiliar from the anti-hero cable drama, a la Liev Schreiber and God knows who else is doing it right now out there, I think Clive Owen brings something new to it.
I will say this for the period part, unlike Mad Men, which is set in the recent, somewhat recent past, the distance that the Nick takes us back to 1900 is far enough that there are some shocking things. I mean, I don't really know much about the practice of medicine in 1900. So, for instance, one thing you see in the pilot is the ambulance drivers essentially competing for sick patients to bring back to their respective hospitals so that their surgeons will have interesting cases to work on, and essentially bribing one another and physically intimidating one another to, like, bring home, like, a prize tubercular patient that, you know, that can be attempted to be cured. And, like, something like that felt like a surprising historical revelation, as opposed to, like, oh, my God, they're not washing their hands, you know, before surgery. Like, we would never do that today.
They do wash their hands before surgery.
But they're not wearing gloves.
All right, fine. Maybe they don't have latex gloves yet. I mean, I also think the production values, there are a couple choices made with regard to production that make this feel really fresh. One is, I think in general, there's a telescoping of time that makes 1900 feel closer than, almost closer than the 1950s of Mad Men in a way. Because what the show is fundamentally about is the frontier of technology. And we are obviously living in a moment when the frontiers of technology are kind of ever on our minds. And there's also kind of an aesthetic note, which I think is intentional, that the current aesthetic vogue in Brooklyn at the moment is very 1890s, right? There's a lot of, like, white porcelain and dark wood. I mean, basically most of the sets where the surgery is conducted could easily be repurposed for, like, chic new restaurants, mm-hmm, in Williamsburg. And so there's a way in which the show has a sense of humor about how far away we consider that time, how close we want it to be, and its parallels with our own.
Yeah, there's nobody who felt more modern than people in 1900, right? That had to be a time when people thought change could not happen faster than it's happening now. All right, on to our next topic. Slate's own Troy Patterson, in a recent Gentleman Scholar column where he answers questions about gentlemanly comportment, had some things to say about talking about the weather and how to work it into a cocktail party conversation in ways that don't bring everything to a deadly grinding halt. Troy says, I don't mean to issue a blanket condemnation of meteorological murmurings. One good reason to talk about the weather is that weather is sometimes bad. Shared hatred and mutual disgust make excellent crucibles of connection. So is that the case? Do we talk about the weather just because we need something to hate together?
I don't know if it's necessarily hate. I mean, to me, the reason people talk about the weather is it's the one thing that everybody lives and observes and has an opinion about. So you know that your interlocutor will have experienced the weather. You don't know if they saw the Met game last night. You don't know if they've seen the new Coons exhibit. And you may not want to offend them by asking them the wrong thing. Maybe they're a Yankee fan. Maybe they don't like Coons. You know, but the weather, they presumably got up, looked out the window, checked their weather.com, you know, and made a decision about what to wear that day. So they've thought a little bit about the weather. I don't know that much. I don't know that I would say that weather's a great cocktail party subject. That seems like it is a kind of death knell for a cocktail party. But what I love about talking about the weather is it just gives you something to talk about with people you don't know and gives you an icebreaker. You know, I had a very pleasant exchange with my barista at Starbucks this morning talking about how cool it's been this August. And it was great. We had a friendly little chat. I really like my barista, and I don't really know much about her. And it gave us an occasion to have a little moment.
It's sort of actuality, right? Current events at its most basic level, like the atmosphere that we're standing in, the air that we're breathing.
Well, I think that's the thing that's most remarkable to me about weather and the extraordinary lack of attention that it gets, both in interpersonal conversation and in writing. I would like to come out here in modest defense of talking about the weather, but in extreme advocacy of writing about it. I mean, it's sort of miraculous, right? The atmosphere every day is distinct and has its own character and mood, and it's very difficult to put into words, and yet it can totally shape your experience of the universe. And not that many writers spend that much time nailing it down, right? I mean, I guess that, you know, some might argue that this is what half of romantic poetry is about, and maybe that's true. But like, you don't find a lot of weather descriptions in novels, so much so that I've been struck by the few where I've found it, and really digging into why a certain day, a certain kind of humidity, a certain cast of light feels a certain way is totally fascinating. It's hard to speak at that level of like subtlety and metaphor and register of analysis in a passing conversation with your cab driver, but I think the weather is important and it affects us all, so to write it off seems stupid. In terms of the conversational aspects of weather, I think we're kind of at a high point for being able to talk about weather in interesting ways because the weather has gotten much more interesting and we've gotten much more aware of it, right? So, you know, Slate just hired a weather blogger, something that I think would not have necessarily been fathomable 10 years ago. But the wonderful Eric Holthaus has started blogging for our Future Tense blog, and he covers extreme weather all over the country. He's covered the drought on the West Coast. He covers the way that the weather is reported. There's lots of interesting stories about the weather, and we know more about weather in other areas because of the internet, because of the nationalization of news, and because you're not just, you know, necessarily listening to your nightly guy in front of the green screen just talk about whatever front is coming to your town that day.
Of course, you're also talking about politics and global economy, and anytime you're talking about weather now, you don't know to what extent you're talking about climate change or not. The two things are woven together in ways that we can't extricate.
Which I would argue makes talking about the weather much more fraught and perhaps not as good a topic as it used to be. Before, you know, 20 years ago, you could offer to someone, hey, like, great sunny day, or do you think it's going to rain this weekend? And you knew it was just a completely anodyne subject. Now you might be wading into a minefield if you're talking to someone who, say, doesn't believe in climate change. Or, I mean, to Troy's point, you might be bringing up a subject that will cause great anxiety in your listener. What if the person you're talking to, you know, lives in Far Rockaway and has a house that's going to be in the path of the next hurricane that hits New York? I feel like talking about the weather brings up all of these fears and anxieties that it maybe didn't in the past, and maybe that makes it a kind of a less good, hey, how you doing, we got nothing to talk about subject. It makes it more interesting, but it makes it more fraught.
More loaded, right. If that person has different political views than you, they might be outraged by the idea that climate change is causing the hot summer.
One of the most beautiful books for writing on weather that I've ever read, and it's not a book that I particularly love or have thought about for any other reason since I read it, is a book called Jonathan Strange and Dr. Norrell, and it was It's sort of like a half fantasy book with fairies set in a mysterious version of England. But the way that the author, whose name is Susanna Clarke, writes about the weather is just striking. Like every scene, every set piece brings you into a very specific kind of day. And you have that flash of recognition, which I think you have more often reading descriptions of faces. I feel like sometimes really good writers, particular kinds of writers, will describe a certain type of face and you'll think, oh yeah, I've seen that face. She had that for me with days. She would describe a particular type of weather, a way that a particular day might feel. And I'd be like, oh yeah, I knew that kind of day. So I'm just going to read a couple. Here's one. The sky had filled with heavy snow-laden clouds. These were scarcely gray at all, but a queer mixture of slate blue and sea green. This curious coloration made a kind of twilight such as one imagines is the usual illumination in fabled kingdoms under the sea. And I feel like I've had that experience of like a weird, greenish, unsettling winter storm where you start to feel like the world is not quite right. Here's another one. It was the eeriest part of a winter day. Twilight was turning all the buildings and people to blurred black nothingnesses, while above, the sky remained a dizzying silver blue and was full of cold light. A winter sunset was painting a swath of rose color and blood color at the end of all the streets, pleasing to the eyes but somehow chilling to the heart. I think also one thing that strikes me here is that if you are a denizen of Instagram, which I am, sometimes there's a complaint that like the Instagram sunset is a horrid cliche and everyone should stop please posting beautiful pictures of the sky. But actually the sky is such a like mesmerizing and wonderful thing to look at that I'm all for people posting pictures of the sky. Like you can't quite capture in an iPhone photo with an Instagram filter always the way a day looks or feels, but to the degree that Instagram is fostering attention to the nature of the day, I think that's a force for good.
I agree. I have no problem with an Instagram sunset. And I sort of like seeing what other people are seeing in other parts of the world. See what a sunset looks like in India 12 hours from when it's going to happen here. It's never going to happen again in just that way.
And it's a testament to the power of the sky and perhaps more specifically the sunset that I completely understand how cliched the photo is as I'm taking it and posting it to my Instagram. And yet I'm powerless to not do it. Like, I don't want to do it, but I'm like, this sunset's so great. I got to share it. People have to see this. And then I post it. I'm like, oh, I probably shouldn't have done that, but oh well.
At least it wasn't your dinner.
Instagram, yeah, exactly.
All right, guys, we've done it. We've reached the end of the show, and it's time to endorse. Julia, what have you got?
I have a rebuttal endorsement.
Ooh.
Dana, I'm rebutting you.
Because my last endorsement blew.
No, your last endorsement was very fine. You endorsed Awesome Mixtape Number 1, which is sort of the Spotify playlist of all the great 70s tracks from Guardians of the Galaxy. But I do not think that that is the greatest 70s soundtrack of all time. In fact, I can think of...
Did I make any such claim?
No, I'm straw-manning you. How dare you call me while I straw-man you? I think that it, for people who are in pursuit... Okay, maybe this is a harmonious joint endorsement. It's an endorsement extension. The 70s soundtrack that I actually fell in love with in high school is the soundtrack to Dazed and Confused, which is informed by director Richard Linklater's amazing musical taste. It just feels like slightly a little grittier, a little less like overblown orchestral bubblegummy than the Guardians of the Galaxy take on the 70s sound. So if you are wanting to delve deeper into cinematic visions of 70s music, I recommend those two soundtracks.
Oh, those are great. I want to make a big, huge playlist for my upcoming long drive of all of those things put together. John, what have you got?
So my endorsement is a great piece of writing about NASCAR, and that piece of writing is actually kind of old. It's from 1965, and it's called The Last American Hero is Junior Johnson. Yes! And from that title, you may have guessed that it's by Tom Wolfe, and it is a piece of writing from Tom Wolfe from 65. It appeared in Esquire. It's actually one of the an early example of Wolfe's kind of great new journalism, and you know, I think Wolfe, some people like him, some people don't. His exuberance can grate, but this is good Tom Wolfe, and it's a great introduction to Junior Johnson, who's one of the foundational figures in stock car racing. And I thought I'd just read a very brief clip. This is actually the lead to this piece. And Wolfe is describing going to see stock car racing in the mid-60s in North Carolina. 10 o'clock Sunday morning in the hills of North Carolina. Cars, miles of cars in every direction, millions of cars, pastel cars, aqua green, aqua blue, aqua beige, aqua buff, aqua dawn, aqua dusk, aqua, aqua malacca, malacca lacquer, cloud lavender, assassin pink, rake-a-cheek raspberry, nude strand coral, Honest Thrill Orange and Baby Fun Lust Cream Colored Cars are all going to the stock car races, and that old mothering North Carolina sun keeps exploding off the windshields. Mother dog! Goes on from there.
Every paragraph is improved by that interjection at the end.
Exactly,
mother dog.
Exactly. And that's actually a pretty good description of a sun, I have to say,
yes.
Per our earlier conversation.
It's good weather talk, too.
It doesn't all like that. It's not all high-octane writing of that nature, but is a really fun way of dipping into some of the earliest examples of Wolf writing like Wolf and also getting a sense of the sort of dawn of NASCAR when it was still kind of... you know, these Southerners who had learned how to drive trying to escape the Johnny Law because they were bootlegging moonshine.
That sounds fantastic.
Oh, and it's on the Esquire website. You just need to, you know, we'll include a link on our page, but it's freely available. It's not hard to find.
For my endorsement this week, I'm going to go back to our conversation about Robin Williams. It seemed like in all the discussion of his great roles last night, a title that I was not hearing very much was Moscow on the Hudson, which is this Paul Mazursky movie that he made in 1984. Paul Mazursky, also someone who left us very recently. He died in June of this year. And Moscow on the Hudson is one of those restrained roles. It's like The Good Will Hunting or what's another role where Robin Williams plays it small and kind of close to the vest. There aren't that many now that I think of it. But Moscow on the Hudson is definitely one. He plays a Russian immigrant who defects. He's a saxophone player in a Russian circus. And on a trip to New York, he kind of falls in love with the consumer goods around him and a beautiful woman he meets. And he's kind of seduced by the West and defects. And the rest of the movie is about his adjustment to living in New York. It is definitely sort of in the sentimental vein of the kind of material that Robin Williams would sometimes choose. But to me, it's not painfully mawkish at all. It's a beautiful, earned sentiment. And it's kind of a wonderful film about America and immigration, and just a great performance by him. I think he learned some Russian, he did a great Russian accent, and he really just, I think, inhabited the character of this, you know, this sort of man on the make trying to find his way in the new world.
That sounds great. I've never seen that movie. I'm not sure I've even heard of that movie.
Yeah, I don't think it got a lot of buzz at the time either. It's not a role of his that's talked about very much, but it's this very lovely sort of small immigrant drama. So again, that's Moscow on the Hudson from 1984. Well, Julia, thank you as always.
Thanks so much, Dana.
And John, thanks for coming in this week to sit in for Steve.
Always a pleasure.
It's great to have you. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And although this radio version of the show will end its run next week, the podcast versions of our shows aren't going anywhere. Just search for Slate Gabfest in iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Volo. Our interns are Max Tanney and Josephine Livingston. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the GabFest crew, I'm Dana Stevens. We'll talk to you next week. Please.